This has been one of the most challenging, and it has been one of the most intriguing assignments, I think, that I've ever had. I wrote Dr. Scare, and I said, what do you want me to talk about when you have selected the topic? He said, that's wide open. You fill it in as you want to. So the fare that I am sharing with you this evening does not come from him, but it represents some of the sweepings and the siftings that I have been doing, particularly with respect in a semi-focus on the apology and a consideration of the word apology, and then a broader look, which in my opinion is extremely intriguing, of where Lutherans, particularly in America, are headed with confessional subscription. I think in this year particularly, or last year, as we were celebrating both the 450th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession and the 400th anniversary of the publication of the Book of Concord, it was very, very intriguing to watch what Lutherans were doing. The Missouri Synod issued a medal to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the publication of the Book of Concord. If, on the other hand, you take a look, you will see ecumenical services that have been conducted from the West Coast to the East Coast. They have been conducted in Europe as well. And on the surface, as you look at these pictures where everybody is showing his new dentures, you sort of get the impression that the Augsburg Confession has no relevance of any kind, that the apology should never have been written, and that the Book of Concord would be better put back on the shelf where it had been here in American Lutheran history back in the early part of the 1800s. Now, what I'd like to do is to take a rather quick look to suggest that I'm sure you probably are even more consciously aware of the various types of confessional subscription that Lutherans have been discussing, particularly during these anniversary years. And we're not through the anniversaries yet, with the apology this year, and then very shortly, Martin Luther's 500th anniversary of his birth, followed by several other anniversaries. But if one would like to paint a picture of where Lutherans in America today are aggregately, I think that perhaps one could best sum that up as saying that every Lutheran communion, every Lutheran organization in America today is very, very unequivocally committed to a binding subscription to the Lutheran confessions. But then, as you begin to probe, you will find that while the confessional subscription is unequivocal, it is a commitment to a equivocal base, and that it is a relative commitment both to the scriptures and to the Lutheran confessions. Take a look sometime at the constitutions of our Lutheran church bodies in America, and I mean the national bodies, not the local parishes. Almost invariably, somewhere, Article 2, or one of the very early articles following the name of the organization, you will find a very, very firm commitment to the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions. But then you begin to read the literature, and you begin to wonder where the contradiction really comes from. I think that as one takes a very, very panoramic view and looks at the concept of confessional subscription today, you will find almost every type being expressed somewhere. From the kind that looks upon confessional subscription, I think the way Lutheranism did in America, beginning perhaps in the post-Civil War period, running almost up to the 1920s and 1930s, and even the 1940s, where you look at the subscription concept as one might carry a rabbit's foot, or to consider the Lutheran confessions as an automatic pilot, where you can completely abandon the theological base and sit back in the back part of the plane and go to sleep, when all of a sudden we hit an air pocket and everybody was jostled terrifically. Now that's one type. There is another type which I think expresses pretty much the Langtonian mania of being constantly involved in redrafting and in revising. That a product which is of confessional substance never really has been put into its final form. It needs to be reviewed, and it needs to be amended, and it needs to be rewritten. There is a third major school, which I believe one can notice very much as one looks around and reads and discusses. And this is that the Lutheran confessions, and this exactly includes also the apology, are historically bound. They are relevant in their historical Sitz im Leben. They can be understood and they can be subscribed to as historical documents, but you cannot take them beyond that point. And this, of course, is one of the answers that had been given to the post-rationalistic period of the Aufklärung in Germany. And I think that it particularly has had its impact upon many Lutherans in America these days. I think, too, that one could also suspect that there is a layering of confessional subscription. If you take a look at some of the constitutional descriptions, demands, if you will, you will find that the Augsburg Confession and Luther's Small Catechism is always named individually. Then after that, there is a sort of a hierarchy of further confessional subscription, ending up sometimes with the Formula of Concord and at other times without it. I think, too, that, and you can document this, that there perhaps is one final type that one probably should also refer to this evening, and that is that anyone who believes that the Lutheran confessions convey a continuing truth to us today, including the large and small catechism, Augsburg Confession, the apology, and so forth, are thereby demonstrating a theological arrogance which really ought not to be tolerated, as though the truth had been deposited there in the formulations that the confessions convey. Now, what I'd like to do is, after having referred to these various types, and I think one could even identify some of the subgroups that are in existence, I would like to suggest that the best picture I believe that we can develop for ourselves of the Lutheran confessions, let's say the Book of Concord, is that which we hear from the pen of St. Paul in Ephesians 2, 19 to 22. Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a habitation of God in the Spirit. And I would like to suggest that as we review this evening that kind of theme, an apology for the apology, that we ought to take a look at the church as having been under construction for all these years, with the apostles and the prophets as having laid the foundation, with Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, but that thereafter there is a construction that is going on. The building is not completed. And there are certain times in the church's history when big blocks are placed there, but they must be in congruence with the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, with Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. And I would like to suggest that this also, I think, presents to us the concept with which the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has been dealing with its own confessional subscription. Not that the confessions have added anything new, not that they have extended the vertical lines of this huge building, but that they are squarely placed upon the doctrine, the apostles, foundation of the apostles and the prophets, with Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. Now, I think even as we take a look, and as you have already taken a look at some of the aspects particularly enunciated in the apology, that the apology itself becomes one of these shining major granite blocks that have been placed there on which we continue to build today, as we are also being joined together, growing into a holy temple in the Lord. I've always enjoyed the foundation which C.F.W. Walther has laid for the confessional principle in the Missouri Synod. I'd like to share a portion of that with you now. Should we dissolutely throw away the fruit of the Reformation, the booty of a thousand-year-old battle of the whole Christian Church, the spiritual inheritance of our spiritual fathers, would we actually faithlessly surrender to our enemies and sacrifice to the indifference of our times what countless martyrs and their blood shed their blood, and what the Church, after enduring the most terrible persecutions, has as its trophy of victory? Oh, let us then be on guard against those who refuse to build on the building of the Church's past, but would build something new. Consider what the Apostle wrote in Ephesians 4, that there is one body, one faith, one baptism, hence also one true church and one correct doctrine, which must not still be found for the first time, for but which always was and will continue unchanged until the end of days, so that all new doctrines and new churches are false doctrines and false churches. Thus we participate in the victory of all true contenders for the unaltered word of God, and become fellow heirs to the full blessing of the Reformation. You know what happened in the days after the Augsburg Confession was very solemnly read. And for 2 hours, people said, and even those in the courtyard were able to hear the words as they were being spoken. But the reaction, and I think that as we think in terms both of Ephesians 2, and as we think in terms of the words read from C.F.W. Walther, that there were two reactions that became of vital importance. One of these was a very sincere, a very concentrated effort to try to overcome, if at all possible, at the Diet, the differences that had been focused between Lutherans and Catholics. Now, you may have the kind of image of Philip Melanchthon that you would like to carry with you for the rest of your life. I have mine, and I'm sure you have yours. Melanchthon, in most of the historical records, has been identified as an individual who was always far ready, more ready, to try to negotiate than to sit down and to draft. There is, however, a new volume which has come out and which I think is absolutely fascinating, by Herbert Immenketter. Maybe some of you have read it. Its title is Confutatio der Augsburgische Confession. In this volume, published in 1979, Immenketter has reached the conclusion that Melanchthon had been authorized to deal with the Roman Catholic Commission, and that he was asked even by the Saxon imperial family and delegated to discharge that responsibility. In addition to that, that he was also asked by all the signers of the Augsburg Confession, and that Luther himself had urged that these conferences take place. Now, whether this particular record corrects or whether it confuses, I do not know. Immenketter, however, insists that he has done research in 20 different archival agencies in Germany, and that he has done a very exhaustive piece of work. Now, whatever Melanchthon's role was, whether he had been commissioned to become the first CTCR, or whether he did this on his own as a volunteer, I think we can leave as an open question. Nevertheless, this was one of the reactions that took place after the Augsburg Confession had raised quite a stir. The second, and that is, of course, the Roman Catholic answer, and you've taken a very close look at that the other day. But I think that regardless of what one might say, it nevertheless is a very interesting reflection that the commissioners of the Roman Catholic Church had been sent back repeatedly. Some say, I didn't really check this out, perhaps Dr. Scare can inform me, how many versions actually appeared before the confutation was approved in the form in which we have it today. At any rate, when these negotiations were going on, Luther, as you know, was sitting extremely impatiently at the Coburg and was complaining that even Melanchthon was not keeping him properly informed. But when Luther heard that Charles V had sent these official, the best German Catholic theologians who could be identified, had sent them back again and again and again to make revisions, Luther commented at the Coburg, "Poor carpenters make many chips, and they spoil much lumber." Immenketter indicates that Melanchthon and Campeggio particularly had engaged in very, very deep consultation on four areas, and that the Catholics, and Campeggio's response was that under no circumstances would they be willing to yield these areas: the cup to the laity, marriage of priests, changes in the mass, and convening a council very shortly. The confutation, as you know, was the result. And again, even after the confutation had been presented, and as Bente reminds us, Johann Kammermeister, with his Latinized name ordinarily used, was the individual who stood there with his tablet and was taking down the notes so that Melanchthon could begin the draft of the apology. But Melanchthon was a reluctant apologist. He just simply did not want to undertake the assignment that had been given to him. Until finally, on that day, on 13 September 1530, he reached the conclusion that his negotiations were not getting him anywhere. And I think one can almost consider that date as the date in which the apology was conceived. When one looks at Melanchthon, regardless under what circumstances or whose version one will take, and perhaps I should share with you the one that has been quite popular, I think among Lutherans particularly, is the one which Schmauch has given us. After the most violent enemies of the Reformation produced the confutation, Melanchthon was still ready to meet with them and offer further concessions. Then he quotes a letter whose authenticity may be disputed, but has Melanchthon tell Campeggio in deepest humiliation, and this is part of that disputed letter, "We have no dogma which is diverse from that of the Roman Church. We venerate the authority of the Roman Pope and are ready to obey him if he does not reject us. And if he will pardon or approve certain small matters which we cannot change, will you reject those who come before you as suppliants? Will you pursue them with fire and sword? Nothing brings so much hatred to us in Germany as the firmness with which we maintain the doctrines of the Roman Church. But with the aid of God, we will remain faithful even unto death to Christ and to the Roman Church, although you should reject us." Now, it is that particular position which Immenkötter, in his new volume, disputes. One, I suppose, could almost look upon Melanchthon the way the farmer and the mule trainer, and I'm sure you've heard that story. The farmer had a huge animal and simply could not get that mule trained regardless of what expertise he applied. So he called in a professional mule trainer and he offered him a good piece of money to train that beautiful animal. And the mule trainer came and he grabbed a 6-foot 2x4 and he hit that mule over the head so that poor animal was just groaning and then buckled and fell to the ground. And the farmer said, "Hey, I told you to train this mule, not to kill him." And the mule trainer said, "Yeah, that's what I'm doing." He said, "But first I got to get his attention." And I think Melanchthon was at the point where they had gotten his attention. After all the negotiations had not paid off in any way, Melanchthon then really began in earnest. And I think that it's very interesting to note the change that this affected in Melanchthon. He almost in scorn speaks of the confutation in these words: "It was written by desperate sophists who maliciously interpret the Holy Gospel according to their dreams, and as coarse, sluggish, inexperienced theologians who for the greater part do not know whereof they speak, who dare to destroy this doctrine of faith with fire and sword." And Carclaeus in 1534, who wrote a tract against the apology, complained bitterly about the young Melanchthon, because Melanchthon had called the priests asses, sycophants, windbags, godless sophists, and worthless hypocrites. And Melanchthon wrote on the margin of that particular note, and he said that Carclaeus was a fierce and vicious, he is, but a barking dog towards those who are absent, but to those who were present at Augsburg, Philip was more gentle than a pup. Now, I think I would like to slip over with a comment, and perhaps you have tried to get a hold of copies of the confutation, as difficult as they are, I suppose, unless I am very badly mistaken, one of the best editions still is the one by Roy, which is a part of his study of the Augsburg Confession. You know the story about it being withheld and that texts were extremely difficult to get a hold of. It didn't take long at all when the apology became considered a part of the confessional corpus. And of course, its official inclusion came in 1537 when the Schmalkald League was in session. But the Formula of Concord, I believe, makes the best statement about it when it was included as one of the official texts in the Book of Concord of 1580. We unanimously confess this apology also because not only is the said Augsburg Confession explained in it as much as is necessary and guarded against the slanders of the adversaries, but also proved by clear, irrefutable testimonies of Holy Scripture. And that's where it has been. Now, as one then hurriedly jumps over the years, and you begin to take a look at what Lutherans have done, Lutherans here in America have done, with the apology, or let's say with the confessional writings beyond the Augsburg Confession and Luther's Small Catechism, one can find that there have been about five different phases here in America. And I think those are of considerable interest. The first one, one can identify as a confessional commitment without any fanfare. And I would like to underscore that the argument from silence, that there isn't a lot of verbiage that is being expressed by Lutherans, whether it is Muhlenberg, whether the Swedes, or whether the Dutch in New York, or the Salzburgers in Georgia, it really does not make any difference. The confessional subscription is there. I can give you the documentation for that if you need to have it. The first stage is, therefore, one which I would like to include as commitment without fanfare. There is a second phase, which I entitled disuse, disinterest, and default. And there are all kinds of factors that have entered in. One was the language transition, for example, that as the immigrants' language, regardless of what it was when they first arrived here, but when they became anglicized, they found out that they were moving farther and farther away from a confessional subscription for a very logical reason. They were unable to read the Lutheran confessions in English. Some of them had been partially translated, but as the apology, for example, this was not available, and it is the Tennessee Synod, as you may well know, that produced the first English Book of Concord in America in 1851. Now, by that time, Lutherans had been living here in America for almost 200 years. They had been living here in America for over 50 years without having the Lutheran confessions available in their own language. And it was during that time that their pastors or their students studied for the ministry at Princeton. They received private tutoring and whatever else. And it is really to be expected that a confessional commitment would fall into disuse until the third, and it, by the way, I'd like to share with you one of the quotations that comes from 1826. The disuse, disinterest, default period runs roughly from the late 1700s until about the 1840s or 1850s. John August Probst wrote about the confessional subscription, to Christian people in general, dogmas about which the preachers of former days quarreled in their publications no longer matter. Such writings are now of interest only to scholars. All the old confessional writings, too, are with time become obsolete and have only historical value. Those times and circumstances are past. Consequently, we are not bound to them, but to the Bible. All enlightened and informed preachers are mutually agreed on this. that much in the hitherto existing confessional writings must be stricken as obsolete and absurd. This was 1826. Now that ushered in the third phase, and that produced one of the great controversies among America's Lutherans, the confessional crisis, and which produced a very distinctly divided Lutheranism. You know the tripwire that was sent, and that was the definite synodical platform of 1855. Now, very interestingly, this period was followed by a period of confessional subscription, which ultimately becomes unanimous among American Lutherans. It did not become effective until 1929. But by 1929, all Lutherans in America, in spite of their previous background and their history, were subscribing to the Lutheran confessions. The fifth phase, and I would like to suggest that this is the phase in which we find ourselves today. It is a phase which has been filled first with satisfaction, because we have been proud of the fact, and I remember distinctly the editorials that were being written in the 1940s, even in the early 1950s, how pleased we were that all Lutherans in America by this time had subscribed to all the Lutheran confessions. But it is also a time which has introduced a new confusion, and in a sense has even introduced a confessional rejection. I would like to demonstrate this very briefly. First, by reading to you another quotation from Walther, which I think is significant. Upon the doctrine contained in these books and upon none other, the first Lutherans were united in ecclesiastical fellowship. Upon this book of confession, and you can just see him hold up that book of Concord, therefore the Lutheran Church is founded, for through it she has come into being, and through it she distinguishes herself from all factions and communions in Christendom. Therefore he who says, I want to be a Lutheran, confesses thereby and professes his adherence to the symbolical books and to the doctrine contained in them. And he who says that he wants to be a Lutheran pastor confesses therewith not only that he holds the articles of faith in these books to be true and right, but also that he will preach them, defend them, and seek to spread them as God gives him grace and power so to do. Actually, for 300 years, the quotation continues, the Lutheran Church has been accused of insisting too rigidly, too firmly, on the symbols, on the very letters of Holy Scriptures. But seldom has anyone dared to say, and never has anyone been able to prove, that they have departed from the Scriptures. If, therefore, we fell away from the teachings of the symbols, we should not be falling away from the word of men, but from the word of God. We should not be denying Luther, but Christ. We should not only cease to be true Lutherans, but also yield the right to be called Christians. Now, I'd like to share with you a manner of subscription among the Episcopalians to the Westminster Confession, and I quote, "We do not suffer any man to reject the 39 Articles of the Church of England at his pleasure, yet neither do we look upon them as essentials of saving faith or legacies of Christ and of his apostles, but in a mean as pious opinions fitted for the preservation of unity. Neither do we oblige any man to believe them," and now listen, but only not to contradict them. One of the, and I did not complete my research, and perhaps Dr. Skarsten can fill me in a little bit, because I did not check who Vance Ekstrom was. Perhaps some of the rest of you here do. But Vance Ekstrom probably is one of the most vocal writers today in opposition to the kind of confessional subscription that Lutheranism had become accustomed to. And there are all kinds of reasons, I believe, why this has happened in the period of the last several decades. We need not go into that because you are as aware of that as I am. I quote Ekstrom in order to indicate to you that today we are in a state of confusion with respect to confessional subscription, and we are back at one of the previous stages where we are deliberately rejecting confessional subscription once more. I quote, "Lutherans created their confessions for the express purpose